I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to Minute 116 of Season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Dean O'Carroll, an award-winning playwright. Welcome back. Welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. This is so great. This is very exciting. This is my favorite movie of all time. So I'm so excited to get to talk about it.
Oh, wow. Okay. I hope you like these minutes.
I do very much. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I there's not a minute in this movie that I don't like.
Ditto.
Yes. So I'm...
Yeah. Okay, great. So minute 116 begins with the taxi pulling up and ends with Ernie cautiously getting worried about some danger. You know, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But, you know, Ernie seems to think something's going on. You know, he cautions Bert.
Sure.
He cautions Bert at the end of this minute.
Right.
So
he says this guy's bat.
That's right. Well, we'll get there. We'll get there. No, the bat says long before that.
Oh, sure.
But yeah. But I mean, you just mentioned this is one of your favorite movies. So what's your history with this movie? Like, do you remember when you first saw it,
like,
where you were exposed to it or whatever?
I do, yes. So like so many people, I would catch bits and pieces of it on TV because during the time when it was, you know, in more or less the public domain, anybody could show it. And it was just anybody showed it all the time throughout the month of December. And I remember watching it. My parents and my aunt and uncle were watching it, and I caught the end of it, I think. One year when I was, 9 or 10. And then I remember the Saturday Night Live sketch of the alternate ending.
Yes.
Where the whole town tracks down Mr. Potter,
right,
and attacks him. And I loved that.
We've talked about that too. Yeah.
And I would, of course, I'm sure it's come up. Yeah. And I remember the, there would be like that. I would catch it from time to time. I feel like I always would see part of the last half hour of it. So I would only ever see the ending and the sort of alternate reality. And I never really saw the backstory until high school when I was taking a class called American Society and Culture Through Film. And we did watch this movie one time, and my film teacher had an incredible screening room at his house and would invite us to come over and do screenings at his house. And so we watched, and I saw a movie all the way through for the first time. And I was so amazed that there's so much more to it and I loved it, of course. And then it was, of course, a regular seasonal thing. And then I married a woman who also calls this her favorite movie. Perhaps I think Barbie might have supplanted it, but it's still in her, you know, her top.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Hey. Yes. And but we adore the movie so much. We watch it at least once a season. We watch it on Christmas Eve. Usually we watch it once beforehand. This year we got to see it on the big screen for the first time. A local revival theater was doing a screening of it, so that was a wonderful experience to finally get to see it on a giant screen.
Yeah, I haven't had that experience.
And,
yet.
Yeah, and it's just been it's a very key part of my Hollywood my seasonal celebrations and understanding.
Oh wow! So I guess this means that you and your wife will be starting a Barbie Minutes by Minute podcast at some point.
I have occasionally suggested she should start a podcast, but no, she's I do not think that's likely in the cards for her. I don't think she'd be interested in that. Much she does love that movie.
Well, yeah, you can suggest it, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So yesterday we ended things with you know, George still trying to figure out this crazy little place known as Pottersville. trying to understand if this is a dream or if he's being hypnotized or like what is really going on here by him. And he flagged down Ernie the taxi driver yesterday and told him to take him home. And Ernie wasn't really sure where his home is, and he told him the address, 240 Sycamore Street, and off they went. Yeah. But right before they left,
And Ernie does that sort of double take.
and he makes a crazy motion to Bert to basically follow along, And this minute.
Something I love about this whole portion of the movie is that even though we're in Pottersville, even though everything is awful, Bert and Ernie are still friends.
Bert and Ernie will
And
always be friends, won't they?
I find that very sweet. And I am certain that this has come up in your discussion of the movie so far. The coincidence, and apparently it is just a coincidence, that these characters share the name with the Muppet pair from Sesame Street.
Yes.
And that I know the Henson people in the Sesame Street people have always said that it is just a coincidence that not deliberately named the characters after these two characters. And I believe that.
You do? I don't. I think it's
Oh, you don't
I
believe
don't
that?
believe that. I
Oh,
don't believe that. But I have a lot of crazy
see
theories
why
about
they
this
would
movie.
lie about it.
I have a lot of crazy theories.
Okay.
I have a theory about the fact that Potter's not really crippled, and that he's just faking it just to get a little
Which
more
is in
sympathy.
the SNL sketch, yeah.
Yeah, well, of course, but I
Now,
still believe that
had you
because I mean you might have an answer of how this happens, but the building alone is on the second floor. So how does Potter get up there each time?
I've always assumed that that big guy who pushes him carries him up,
Probably, but then how does he carry him up with the chair?
Well, either they carry him. Well, they have to either carry him in the chair or carry him, make two trips. Yeah, no, I'm not saying it would be easy, but I don't think Mr. Potter cares about making life easy for other
Yeah,
people.
that's
So,
true. That's lurch for
interesting.
you, you
Yeah,
know.
true. I suppose it is possible that he might not be confined to the chair; that it might be easier for him, but he could possibly, when necessary, get out and work with a cane or something. But he'd prefer to be more mobile in a chair. Yeah, I suppose that's possible.
Right.
But
Again, it's just one of the
Mr.
theories.
Potter, of
It's a
course.
theory that we will never be able to prove either way. There's.
Mr. Potter is, of course, 70 years old for about 40 years in this movie.
Yes.
So he definitely is—he's a medical oddity in many ways.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I'll actually even bring it up now. I was going to wait until later in the week, but it makes sense right now. Whenever the entire time that George is in Pottersville, we never see Potter.
I know. I love that. I
So
mean,
my,
I would love more
there's,
Mr. Potter. He's a great character.
my theory is that it's possible that Potter is dead.
Oh, okay.
He's created this snowball effect, of this crazy town over the last 20 years. Then he doesn't still need to be there. He could have someone who continues, his I guess reign of terror, if you want to call it that.
Yes, absolutely. And that would raise the question of, how did he die? Was it just, he was living a more of a high life and died of natural causes or in an accident or something? Or, of course, was there foul play?
Well,
We know
I
that.
would say that he actually died because he didn't have someone to fight like George, so therefore he had no reason to live.
That is an interesting idea because that would be then a parallel to Mary not having something to wish
Exactly.
for.
Exactly.
Which, yeah. Yeah, that is an interesting idea. In Back to the Future 2,
Yes.
when you see Biff, after Biff has traveled back in time to change history and he returns to 2015, the far-flung future, he stumbles out of the car and he's not doing well. And as shot, he then faded out of existence. And they cut it before that, so you don't see that. And I remember watching a special about the making of it at the time, or shortly after, maybe it was coming out on VHS or something. And they said, well, we need to assume that he was shot by Lorraine at some point between 1985 and 2015.
Yes.
And that is a really interesting idea. But it didn't. But however, it didn't go into effect somehow until he
Well, you see,
traveled back in
that's
time.
part of
I see why they cut. That would be
that's
confusing.
part of the fallacy of Back to the Future 2, which I love. But once he changes history, he can't, or once he changes the future, he can't then go back to where he was. Everything would have changed around them. So it's a little bit of a fallacy. But on the other hand, in the first movie with Marty making all these different changes and his brother is slowly fading out on the picture, so maybe it takes a little bit of time for history to catch up to itself. Maybe that's part of the theory
That does
in
seem
that
to be the
movie.
case, yeah.
So
And
by the time
yeah, that
he
would seem to be the
finally
case,
gets
certainly.
back to 2015, it's trying to catch up to him, but he's already dead. So, he just disappears from existence there. I mean, that makes a lot of sense also.
And we do have to assume that for that, now we're talking about the wrong movie,
We're
but we do have to
not.
assume that he also
Once
took
again,
him a while to
Dean,
figure out how it
you
worked.
have to know how these things work. You're never talking about the wrong movie because there's a connection. So,
True. Right, yes, just as It's a Wonderful Life is very much connected to A Christmas Carol and all its various tellings,
but there's no time
yeah,
travel or a change of reality.
Right, yes, well, you don't, you, It's a Wonderful Life, you can't change the past, but you can change the future, we're told.
Well,
So,
of course. You can change the future without having to go into the future. You just see it. You get a view. You see the window into the future.
right. If I can take a step back just a bit to Bert and Ernie and Sesame Street, two things about this. Had you discussed the time when Sesame Street did acknowledge the connection?
Yes, when the two of them are walking by a screen and they see the two of them and they like just they break the fourth wall and just look at the camera.
Yes, in Elmo Saves
Yes.
Christmas from the mid-90s. Okay, I assume this must have come up at some point
Yes.
since we're so
Yes,
deep
yes,
into the
yes,
movie,
yes, yes.
but. I do remember watching that with my kids and discovering that. I'm like, oh, finally they acknowledged it. So the other thing, and this is getting a little bit abstract, a little self-promotional. For many years, I was a joke submitter for Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. This was all done by email. I was never in in the offices, never in the studio. But I did occasionally get a joke on the air. The joke is there's a new study suggests that women pursue men with strong brows and square jaws for short-term romance, but seek out men with softer, rounder features for long-term commitments. In other words, you date Bert, but you marry Ernie. So that was my first professionally sold television joke many, many years ago. So I've always felt indebted to the characters for that. And those also they were my favorite on during my own Sesame Street days. Those two.
Oh, wow,
So
that's really
and
cool.
Bert and Ernie here in the movie are. I mean, every character in this movie is my favorite character, of course. But I do love Bert and Ernie very
Yeah.
much.
So my question now is did was that the first draft of what you sent into them, or did they tell you to tweak it a little bit or something like that, or did they accept it as is?
They rephrased it just a tiny bit. The way they would work was they would send us the regular writers and us joke submitters setups, which would just be one or two sentence sort of news story summaries, and we would use those to write our jokes. And sometimes you would just take exactly what they sent you and just write a punchline for it. Sometimes you would modify it if you needed, the words to be phrased a little differently to set you up correctly. And that one, the only change they made, I think, is they changed the setup slightly. So they changed what they had sent me. They just, I think, cut out a few words to streamline it a little bit. But no, yeah, I had over the many years that I was doing that, I had five jokes on the air, and pretty much always verbatim. One other one, which I got shared credit for, because one of the regular writers had more or less the same idea. I think they used her phrasing rather than mine. I don't know why I'm saying her. It might have been her. It might have been a woman. Might have been a man. I'm not sure actually, but. Yes, no, they would usually pretty much, because I mean, with a joke like that, that's, you're trying to be so precise and concise that tinkering with even a few words here and there could really throw things off.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. I mean, I'm a big fan of Weekend Update, so I'm familiar with the way the jokes go, and some of them work and some of them don't. So,
Absolutely, yeah.
but yeah, wow, that's
And
really cool that you were able to do that. So.
That was a very fun time doing that, and I got to meet Amy a couple of times and let her know who I was and that
She's like, oh,
what a
you're the
great show
Bert
it
and
was
Ernie
and took all
guy.
my jokes.
Oh,
And I met Seth Meyers once too, and the only other person who ever did one of my jokes was Colin Jost, who I've never met, but someday who knows.
was who?
Colin Jost.
Oh, Colin Jost.
When he did one of mine,
that Mr. Scarlett Johansson.
When he was. Yes, exactly. Yes. So I feel like, let's see. So my words have come out of his mouth, and his mouth has been used to kiss Scarlett Johansson. So it's okay.
All right. If that's what you want, if that's what you want pat yourself on the back for, that's good.
Exactly. Right. Yep.
All right. So Ernie shows up in front of the dilapidated house that George and Mary used to live in, I guess you could say, or in the alternate universe we're living in. And Ernie goes, "Is this the place?" He goes, "Of course it's the place." And I mean, it's interesting because Ernie is he's the taxi driver of Bedford Falls, so he must know every place. You know, if you're gonna say I want to go to 320 right. Sycamore Street, he knows where that is. You know, so you know he should already have known that. Oh, you're going to this, I guess, haunted house or deserted house, however you want to refer to it. You know, he should have already been aware of that at that point. And George is adamant, and he's obviously still in denial that he's in some sort of alternate universe here. Something like that. And then Ernie just looks at him and goes, "Well, this house ain't been lived in for 20 years. So what they're basically saying is that nobody lived here since 1925. Now, are you familiar with the timeline in the movie?
Let's see. So 1925. So
like, when did they throw the rock?
Now the night of the graduation dance, mm-hmm. where Mary throws the rock, that's supposed to be 28.
Yes, that is 1928.
Okay, that's 28. Yeah. So that would imply, and of course he may have been just rounding off, and maybe it was actually 23 years or whatever. So that would imply that the house had been empty for 3 years by that point.
Correct. Which makes it seem really strange that this house is so decrepit. I guess, back in 1928, there's, you'd think that the house would have been deserted for much longer at that point. But I think you're right. I mean, Ernie's just throwing out a round number.
Right. And it may be, it could be a situation where like, oh, there was, an old lady living in there whose family had owned the house and she was, dying, only lived in, in one or two rooms and the rest of the house was falling apart and she wasn't maintaining it. I just started watching the original British version of the show Ghosts, which I'd heard about for a while, and I'm really enjoying it. And that's how that starts. That the haunted house in that is inhabited mostly by ghosts. The first scene is the old woman who lives there dying on her deathbed, and the house is very run down. So I would accept that as a possibility. Certainly in a Pottersville version of Bedford Falls.
Right. Okay. That's fair. And as George is starting to look around, trying to figure out what's going on, so Bert shows up, and he goes, "What's up, Ernie?" He goes, "I don't know, but we better keep our eye on this guy. He's bats."
He's bats, yes.
So, I mean, I just tried looking up, what the term bats means. And, I sort of did the mistake that a good friend of mine, I'm pretty sure it was DJ Valentine, mentioned to me that, you're not supposed to look things up on the Urban Dictionary because you're never going to find what you really want. You're going to find some crazy definitions of things that you don't even want to repeat because they're just so out there. They have 150.
Somebody always has an agenda.
That's right. They have 150 pages in the Urban Dictionary of meanings of the word bat or bats or something like that. And I went through a lot of them. I didn't go through all of them in the end because that was just way too much time to go through that. But I found one that was really interesting that has nothing to do with this movie, but it's an acronym for bridge and tunnel. Okay.
Oh, okay.
What it basically means is that it's what people call
people from New Jersey,
yeah, exactly. People from New Jersey who on the weekends, travel into Manhattan. So they have to go there either via the bridge or the tunnel, looking for an exciting night in the city and stuff like that. So they're known as bats, bridge and tunnel people. So I just thought that was
certainly had heard the term bridge and tunnel. Yeah. I never heard abbreviated to bats. That is interesting.
Yeah.
Now, so other terms, related terms that are used to mean mental illness, and we always need to be cautious about stigmatizing that at all these days. Batty, pretty much the same thing as calling someone bats, and bats in the belfry.
That's right.
And I do wonder if maybe batty and bats both come from bats in the belfry, or if they're just all, you know, from some other source or disconnected or
what. Okay, well, what I found was this. First of all, a few other derivatives of it. Basically, bats means crazy, insane, eccentric, which is really strange that you would say eccentric and crazy are the same. You know, maybe eccentric is just a nice way of calling someone crazy. You have the derivative batso, which is an adjective that you use for someone also that's a little crazy. They started using the word bats to mean crazy in 1924.
Oh, okay.
Okay. There's a novel by G. Henderson called Keys to Crookdom, which refers to someone to go bats. And that was basically the first time that someone used that. And I mean, I have a list of like 15 or 20 other examples of in I guess pop culture over the years where they use that phrase bats, but it stopped being popular around the 60s. People were using it less, and so there's very few places where people are calling other people bats since then. So, yeah. No, I just thought it was very interesting.
The best, probably.
Yeah. Basically.
Now, pretty much just the Joker will use it against Batman.
Yeah, of course.
Call him Bats or Batman.
Yes. Yeah. But he's not meaning the same type of thing. Or maybe he is. You know, maybe he's referring to him to being crazy. And then, I mean, what happens next is it basically does show that if you're looking at it from a perspective of someone who doesn't know what's going on, you definitely would think that George has gone bats, because we see him like wandering around the dilapidated house, and he goes, "Mary, Mary, Tommy, Pete, Janie, Zuzu, where are you?"
Yeah.
And
yes. Yeah. You could, you certainly, Bert and Ernie are pretty blameless for thinking that George is not well. Now, here's a question. I don't know if I'd ever thought of this before. Is George still intoxicated at this point? Because when history changes, his lip heals, his ear heals. So would whatever the, poisonous, to use a dramatic word, effects of alcohol had in the system, would they also be eliminated?
Yes, I believe so, because he doesn't exist. So that means he didn't drink and he didn't get drunk. But
I think that
he was at Nick's, he did drink again. So I don't know. I don't know if you'd say that
Oh, that's true. Yes, he did have another drink.
But he's not drunk yet. But he has had something to drink, before Nick kicked him out.
Right. And I was going to wonder, like, would his clothes would he smell like liquor? But probably even if he hadn't, a jump in the river probably would have washed some of that liquor.
Well, again, his clothes are all dry because
it's not his breath.
His clothes are all dry. So. And when he was having his second discussion with the man whose grandfather planted that tree, the guy smells him to see if he's if he smells somewhat of alcohol. So
yeah, So is Jimmy Stewart still playing with a little drunk at that point?
I wouldn't necessarily say that he's drunk. I think he's more, I've had this discussion a few weeks ago when he actually was drunk, that maybe it just has to do with the fact that he's very distraught. So I think at this point he's getting more and more distraught because he's trying to figure out what's going on with his reality.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's more or less what's
He,
going
you know,
on.
he probably he of course thinks he's still a little drunk. Probably they're probably chalking up some of this to, like that he had been drinking heavily beforehand. He does not, doesn't accept these changes. He wouldn't accept that he's magically sobered up.
That's
So
right. That's right. And
yeah.
while he's walking around, so Ernie like shines a really bright light on him. And as George is trying to get into the house, and then we see like tons of cobwebs, and then he enters. Did you notice that there's some graffiti on one of the walls? Around the 42nd
I think
mark.
I have noticed that in the past.
All right. So on the
Yeah.
42nd mark, there's graffiti on the wall that says Jerry and Johnny, J-O-N-I. I tried looking that up. I tried.
Yes.
I was hoping that there were like crew members with that name or anything like that, but there's nobody that I could find listed on IMDb with either of those names. So it's anyone's guess what that actually means, Jerry and Johnny. I mean, one of the things that I've come to figure out throughout doing this season. Do you remember the name of the two main? I guess you can call them angels or spiritual beings.
With Joseph, and I don't believe the other one's given
yes,
a name.
Yes,
is
the
he?
other one's name is Franklin.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, and at one point, were they actually going to have it be like Benjamin Franklin? Is that?
I don't know about that, but my guess is that Franklin is supposed to be God, basically. And who is the God of this particular movie? Frank Capra.
Oh, Frank Capra. Oh, of course. Okay, that's right. Yeah,
and,
I'll buy
and,
that. Yeah.
And one of the main writers was Joe Swerling. So there you have Franklin and Joseph.
And Joseph, yeah.
You have the director and the writer, dealing with that type of thing. So
I have a book here in front of me. It's The Essential It's a Wonderful Life, Scene by Scene Guide to the Classic Film by Michael Willian. He says that the graffiti says Jerry and Tony, T-O-N-I.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I don't know if that changes anything at all. They do not offer any further insight into it other than the fact that it's there. So, all right.
That's really interesting because it looked like it was Joni, but I guess it makes sense. I mean, I'm not going to argue with the essential guide to It's a Wonderful Life. they must know what they're talking about at that point. But it's interesting that they don't know. They weren't able to figure it out either. So that I guess that's a good thing. I'm not alone in the fact that I can't figure out who Tony or Joni is.
Right. And if it was a set dresser referencing his children or his wife, that is lost to history. One thing I learned from that book is that I forgot exactly the source on this, but they said that in the very beginning, the sledding scene, the other kids sledding are supposed to include Bert and Ernie, both, that they allegedly were all contemporaries.
Really?
Of
okay.
George,
I never
and,
thought about that. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, because we know that Marty's there. Marty, the brother of
right,
the brother of the bride who doesn't show up at the wedding.
They do seem to be fairly casual about weddings in the Paley family because, yeah, so Marty's not at the wedding. Uncle Billy's not at the wedding because I guess he had to work that day.
Well, what about Harry?
And then, of course,
Harry and Ruth?
Harry just
Harry
know,
and,
runs off at the
Harry and Ruth are not yes. there either.
Harry and Ruth aren't at George's wedding. That's
nope.
true.
Nope.
And they didn't have anybody at their wedding. And I wonder, like, should we assume was Ruth pregnant? Was it a quickie wedding that they had? No mention of
I
that
don't know.
Is ever made.
We never find out if they have kids because Ruth never shows up again.
Yeah, I'm sure this has come up that the actress who played Ruth died only a year or two ago, right?
Yes. Yes, I believe
yes,
we
yeah.
Talked
so
about that.
That's a good long run for her.
Yeah, and.
Yeah. So who's still alive? Some of the kids, right?
I'm pretty sure Zuzu is still alive. The actress who played Zuzu, and I think one of the boys, maybe Petey is still alive. I'm trying to remember. I did look this up at some point. But most of
no, I'm sure
most of the
discussed.
cast are not around. I mean, this movie is 78 years old.
Right. Well, I mean,
or 77 years.
Time, we're coming up on 80 years for this movie.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've discussed this, guesses as to what Zuzu's real name is. We assume that she is not, that's not Zuzu on her birth certificate. Do we assume it's short for Suzanne or Susan?
That's
or
what Elizabeth? I believe.
Do we have,
I believe
any,
it's
do you have any guesses? Or
I believe it's Susan. But I don't, I mean, again, these are,
which is not a sort of,
these are things we'll never know.
Right? Yeah. As far as you know, that's not a family name, right? So Peter is named, of course, after George's father.
That is correct.
And then the other girls, Janie, and yeah. What's the little boy's name?
Now, Tommy could be named after, after,
Tom.
What's going on? After Mary's father, because we never meet Mary's father.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, again, we never know. Okay, so Larry Sims, who plays Petey, passed away in 2009. Okay, Carolyn Grimes, who plays Zuzu, is still around. She was born in 1940. So that means she's 84 or 83 at this point, because it's her birthday's in July. Jimmy Hawkins, who played Tommy, is still around. He was born in 1941.
Okay.
So he's still around.
That's relative spring chicken.
Yes. Well, you know, when looking at it from that perspective, yes. And then Carol Coombs, who played Janie, is also still alive. She was born in 1935. Again, according to IMDb, this is old information. According to IMDb, so you know, let's hope that information is correct. And
I did look up recently, and this is somewhat relevant, that I think there is one final surviving Little Rascal, unless he has died since I did look that up, and since we do have a Little Rascal in this movie,
that we do,
that there's one last rascal standing.
We have a little rascal that died like 10 years after this movie came out because he was shot. You know.
I know. Yeah, that is a sad story. His whole life story.
Alfalfa.
Yeah. Something I love about watching the movie every year is that I learned so much. Like, I learned only this year that the woman who during the bank run asks for, I forget exactly how much he asked for.
$17.50. That's the mother, like, the grandmother and the Waltons. Right. That's right. And she won an Oscar the year after.
I know of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And she has this tiny little part in this movie. Well, when you're wonderful, so many great faces in this movie. That is, as Hollywood insists on more and more beautiful people playing every single role in movies, you do miss great character faces like you get in a movie like this.
That's true. That's true. And then as George is walking around this dilapidated house, so Clarence shows up and Clarence says to him, "They're not here, George. You have no children." He goes, "Where are they? What have you done with them?" At this point, you know, George just doesn't know how to respond to all these different things. And Clarence, I love the way that Clarence just tells things as it is. You know, he states things matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
You know, they're not here. You don't have any children. That's it, you know. So.
And I think an audience member could be forgiven for getting frustrated with George that he doesn't sort of understand the premise of this. But how could he? That's not something you can just accept.
Right.
You know, and since Clarence does come across as so befuddled and daffy, you know, why would you say, like, oh, of course, yes, this little man has changed history.
That's right.
in order to teach me a lesson. So yeah, it doesn't matter how many times he's told it. Of course, he's not going to fully accept it until the very
end. Yeah, for sure. And then we hear Bert screaming from outside. He goes, "All right, put up your hands. No fast moves. Come on out of here, both of you." So my first question, and we'll get more into this later this week. You know, not in episodes where Dean's here, but you know, Bert. You know, the way that Bert polices Pottersville is not necessarily how one wants a policeman to act. You know, like, he seems to have no reason to start screaming at them.
That there's some basic, that there's, you also see there's some basic kindness to Bert. Like later on, he says, you know, oh, be a good kid, come with us, you know. And then a second later, he's going to, you know, knock George out with a blackjack or something. And later on, he goes, does, you know, fire a gun into the streets. Onto a crowded street on Christmas Eve. So, yes, he has definitely changed. But you also see in the scene that there is a layer of kindness to this. Ward Bond, an interesting career. A supporting actor for so long in life. And then I guess at the end of his life, he had the lead on the show Wagon Train, which I only know as, you know, that Gene Roddenberry said that when he was creating Star Trek, he wanted to be more like Wagon Train than like Gunsmoke, because Wagon Train would travel into trouble, whereas Gunsmoke, trouble had to come into town. So I only know that that was Ward Bond was the lead on Wagon Train and then died a few seasons in and was replaced without much explanation as to why.
Well, because they just had the, you know, they were just like if you were to switch the captain of the Enterprise, you know, just happened as it's moving along.
Yeah, right.
And George gets ecstatic and he goes, "Bert, thank heavens you're here."
Yeah.
And then there's a really strange line right after that where we hear Bert say, "Back this." I don't know what that means.
Back this, yes. Yeah.
And then he goes, "Bert."
I can offer no theory as to what that what that would mean in context.
Me neither. And he goes, "Bert, what's happened to this house? Where's Mary? Where's my kids?" Like, it's funny that he's asking Bert all of these questions, you know, because he believes that Bert will know the answers.
And Bert so far, so,
and Bert just thinks, you know, that this guy's just completely crazy. You know,
Bert presumably knows Mary Hatch, probably, you know, we'll bump into her on the streets once in a while. And, you know, she's, you know, quiet and retiring, but there's got to be more than one Mary in town. So that's not going to be.
Yeah. But, you know, retiring at the age of 33. I don't know. But we'll get there in a few days. we'll get to that.
Yeah.
And then the minute ends with Ernie basically cautioning Bert. And he says, "Watch him, Bert." that's what Bert needs. Bert needs, you know, the taxi cab driver telling him, you know, be careful. You don't know what's gonna happen. You don't know what this guy's gonna do. Just be careful. Be careful. And that's basically all I have for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
I don't think I do. Let me double check here. Because I think that, you know, wherever I watched this, I think it might have been a slightly different sync of the minute, so my notes are minute by minute off a little bit, but we'll catch up. That's not a problem. So it's, you know, it's good stuff. It's so intense. I mean, the movie is there's so much lightness and humor all along for ultimately a very serious story that we're dealing with some pretty serious minutes here. But I, like I said, I love every minute of this movie.
All right, great. So. Normally every Thursday we have this segment, but because, you know, today's episode is coming out on a Saturday and Dean will not be with us on Thursday. So we're going to do today the segment for Thursday of Jimmy Stewart Thursday. So, Dean, why don't you give us your top five Jimmy Stewart, performances, start from your number five and work your way up.
All right. Excellent. Well, I will preface this and I may repeat this over the course of my time here. That I am not a film scholar, I'm not a film expert. There was a time when I thought I was. I even actually taught film once or twice in my day, and then I realized that I'm not actually an expert at all. I'm just a guy who likes some movies.
And what's wrong with that?
I've not seen everything that Jimmy Stewart's ever been in. Exactly. Yeah. No. I just don't want to misrepresent myself.
Let's put it this way. I don't expect any of my guests to have seen every single Jimmy Stewart movie. So you're in the clear.
Thank you. I do often call him my favorite actor, but I'm realizing that there's so much of his filmography that I've not seen, and I would like to catch up. As I get older, there's a certain point I realize, like, I'm just not ever gonna see that movie, and that's okay. With a lot of Jimmy Stewart's movies, I do think that I do want to get around to them. So okay, number five. This is the only one that's, I think, going to be kind of surprising on this list. The rest are all going to be sort of, you know, the usual suspects, and that's Rope. The Hitchcock movie.
Yeah.
Generally considered a lesser Hitchcock movie. and kind of just a stunt that it's done in a series of very long takes. That there's five or six takes for the whole movie, and they would have had fewer if it was possible to have that much film in a canister at that time, and based on a stage play, so sort of shot kind of like a stage play. And the premise is that in the very beginning of the movie, two men kill somebody, hide the body in like a trunk, and then have a dinner party to come over. And it sort of gets tenser and tenser until the body is discovered. And Jimmy Stewart plays the two killers. I think he's their college professor or a former college professor who had sort of spoken philosophically about murder as an art form. And of course, because he was an intellectual, it was just an intellectual exercise for him. And over the course of the movie, as he's confronted with the reality of a murder, he sort of loses it and then comes down. And he remains a voice of authority. But I remember watching with a friend of mine, and he pointed out that when he's finally confronting them, and sorry to spoil the movie, but when you see the murder at the very beginning of the movie, it's kind of inherently spoiled. When he's confronting him, like, you killed this person because you thought you were morally superior to him. And now what's going to happen to you is you're going to be arrested and you're going to be put to death. My friend pointed like, oh, because the state is morally superior to you and there has the ability to execute you the way you execute these people. An interesting take on morality there. But, wonderful Jimmy Stewart performance in that
yes.
one. So that's, as I said, that's my only sort of real unusual one on this. Number four, I got to go Philadelphia Story. Jimmy Stewart at his comic best. And boy, are there three better movie stars in history than Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, and Katharine Hepburn? And there they are all in one movie together. So I that's such a great one. And a movie where, Cary Grant, as great a comic leading man as Hollywood ever had, and Jimmy Stewart totally gives him a run for his money in that movie. And of course, he won the Oscar for that one. Mm-hmm. There's a moment in that, speaking of Jimmy Stewart playing drunk, where you see him in the morning, he's been out drinking, and I think he's carrying Katharine Hepburn home, like she's so passed out, he's in her arms, and he's walking along, and he's singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And you have to take a step back and realize, oh, if that were in a movie now, it would be somebody singing an old song they remember from their childhood. But since that movie came out in 1940, a year after Wizard of Oz, he was singing a then contemporary pop hit. He was like, as if he was singing, a Taylor Swift song now. That's just kind of odd to think that there was a time when that was a new song, that it wasn't a standard that everybody sort of heard cradle to grave. Number three, I imagine this would be many people's number one, Vertigo. Of course, that's an incredible performance. That's a great movie. Not my personal favorite Hitchcock, but I get the hype for it, and he's so good at it with I didn't include Rear Window in this, and of course Rear Window is excellent too, and maybe that's better than Rope, but maybe I wanted to have something unusual in there. Number two, I gotta go Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. That is I love that movie so much. I love his performance in it so much. So sincere, so honest. Old fashioned, of course. Of course it is, but I absolutely love every moment of that movie, and just his arc in that, and I love, as much as we get on Capra for being sentimental, I love that in the end of the movie he passes out, and then he is still out when the movie ends. That even though that he does not know that he's had a happy ending in this, that he's he's collapsed of exhaustion. And then everything, and then everything comes out. And when he wakes up, things are going to be okay. But we don't get that moment of seeing him waking up. We just get to know that. And so that's, so yes, Capra is justifiably categorized as a sentimentalist. But he doesn't give us that. Doesn't give us, Jeff, everything's going to be okay, Jeff. We just, just ended and let us fill in the gaps. And then number one. Unsurprisingly, it's this movie. It's a Wonderful Life. I think George Bailey is one of the greatest characters in movie history, and such a wonderful performance by him. And I was amazed to learn that he was not yet a father when he made this movie. That he wasn't married yet. He was a swinging bachelor, I think, in Hollywood throughout the most.
Yeah, he was known for being one of the big bachelors of the 40s.
Yeah. And then fell in love and married. And I believe did he have any biological children, or did he just become a stepfather to his wife's?
If I remember correctly, he did not have any any biological children.
Okay. Because his performance as a father is so gripping in this, and just when he just, you know, squeezes his children to them, you know, first in the scene where he first comes home after losing the money, and then of course, you know, in the end, when he's overjoyed, he's, you know, crushing them all on the stairs in his arms. It feels so real and so so honest. You know, Jimmy Stewart was not a realistic or naturalistic actor by contemporary standards. I would say that compared to a lot of his contemporaries at the time, who I love, people like Cary Grant and so on, he was probably more realistic. But he had this incredible ability to create a reality that you could get drawn into, that you immediately accept the reality of a character like George Bailey, like Jefferson Smith, that even if it's not actually what it would be like to know a person in real life like this, you completely buy into it, which is not an ability unique to Jimmy Stewart, but something that he was so good at.
Right.
So that is my top five Jimmy
Stewart.
Okay,
Stewart's. Well, first of all, I want to correct something that we just said. They actually did have two children. His wife, her name was Gloria Stewart, not the Gloria Stewart from Titanic, you know, because Stewart is also spelled a little
right.
differently. She had two sons from a previous marriage that Jimmy Stewart adopted, Ronald and Michael McLean. And then they had twin daughters together, Judy and Kelly Stewart.
Excellent.
And she actually
oh, no,
almost
I'm a twin father myself.
She actually almost died giving birth, and she spent a month in the hospital recuperating after having her twin daughters.
Gosh. Well, I'm glad she made it. That would have been a very tragic
yes,
thing to happen to them.
That's very true.
Yeah, I'm a twin father myself, so I'm very happy to know that I had that connection with
there you go. That's great. All right, so Dean, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Sure. So if you're interested in me and my work as a writer, I'm a playwright. My plays are mostly produced by high school and middle school drama clubs. And you can find my work at, most of my plays are published by PlayScripts. So if you go to playscripts.com and search for me, you'll find some of my plays like Sally Cotter and the Censored Stone and Star Stars, The Franchise Awakens, and Back to the 80s. So you can kind of see the kind of things that I write, which are mostly parodies of pop culture franchises for kids to have fun putting on. I do have one Christmas play, which I think is relevant to this. It's a collection of short pieces, actually, called Chestnuts Roasted, and that's published by a different company called Hoyer Publishing. So if you search for Chestnuts Roasted by Dean O'Carroll, you'll find those. That does not have a anything with It's Wonderful Life in there. I thought about it. I was toying with the idea of writing something. It would be something along the lines of like George Bailey and Ebenezer Scrooge cross paths somehow on their time travel journeys, which, I mean, not that George Bailey time travels, but I never could quite make that work. And also, it's possible that I just love this movie too much to do anything remotely like making fun of
okay,
it.
Okay, I can understand that.
I just couldn't bring myself to it. But that the... But that collection does have, it has parody of A Christmas Story. It has a parody of Charlie Brown Christmas and a film noir riff about Santa's reindeer. So yeah, so if so those are lots of fun if you're looking for just, you know, one short piece or an evening of short pieces for your next holiday stage play, that would might be one to look
at. All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.